corresponding to our automobiles for convenience in traveling from one place to another. I saw conveyances patterned and somewhat after the mothership in miniature. They appeared to glide along just above the ground, as had those buses I saw on the moon. These transports varied in size as do our cars, and some had open tops. I was wondering how they were propelled, which brought Orthon again close to my ear as he explained, by means of exactly the same energy as operates our spaceships. The streets were well laid out and beautifully bordered with flowers of many colors. Next, I was shown a beach on the shore of the lake. The sand was very white and fine. Long, low waves rolled in with an almost hypnotic quality. There were many people on the beach and in the water. I wondered what kind of material could be used for their bathing suits, as they looked no wetter after a dip in the lake than before. Kalna, who had come to sit beside me, cleared this up. The material is not only entirely waterproof but also has properties which repel certain injurious rays from the sun, even as on Earth, she went on to explain. These rays are more powerful when reflected off water than inland. We were now shown a tropical section of Venus. I was amazed to notice that, in general sense, many of the trees somewhat resembled our weeping willow, since the foliage tended to fall in a kind of cascade effect. The color, however, and details of the leaf were quite different. As you may imagine, I was very interested in the animal life that entered the various scenes. On the beach I had noticed a small, short-haired dog. Elsewhere, birds of various colors and sizes, little different from ours on Earth. One looked identical to our wild canary. I saw horses and cows in the country, both slightly smaller than those of Earth but otherwise very similar. This seemed to hold true of all animal life on Venus. The flowers, too, resembled those that grow on our Earth. I would say that the main difference between both animal and plant life on Venus as compared with ours lies in coloring and flesh texture. This, Kalna told me, is due to the ever-present moisture on their planet. As you have learned by now, she said, our people rarely see the stars as you do on Earth. We know the beauties of the heavens beyond our firmament only from our travels and studies. Last, they showed the picture of a very beautiful woman and her husband with their 18 children, all but one of whom were fully grown. Yet the parents gave the impression of a young couple in their early 30s. This ended the showing and I was invited to ask questions. First, I asked what effect, if any, the constant cloudy condition over Venus has on its peoples. Orthon replied, in addition to living according to universal laws, our atmosphere is a contributing factor toward an average lifespan of 1,000 years. When the Earth, too, had such an atmosphere, man's years on your planet were correspondingly far greater than now. The cloudy formation surrounding our planet acts as a filter system to weaken the destructive rays which otherwise would enter its atmosphere. I call your attention to a record contained within your own holy writ. If you study it carefully, you will notice that the span of life on Earth began to decrease when the cloudy formation lessened and men for the first time saw the stars out in space. It may interest you to learn that a gradual tilting of your Earth is even now taking place. If, as could happen at any moment, it should make a complete tilt in order to fulfill its cycle, much of the land now lying under water will rise. For years to come, this water-soaked soil will be in a process of evaporation which will once more cause a constant cloudy formation, or firmament around your Earth. In which case, the lifespan will again be increased, and if the peoples on your planet learn to live according to the Creator's laws, you too can attain 1,000 years in the one body. This tilting of your Earth is one reason for the constant observation we are giving it, for its relation to the other planets in our galaxy is very important. A drastic tilt of one planet would, to some degree, affect all, and definitely alter the lanes in which we travel space. Surely, any violent tilt would cause a great catastrophe to our Earth, would it not? I asked. That is bound to happen, he replied, and although the laws which govern the relationship of man to the world on which he lives would not at this present time be understood by men of Earth, I want to stress that the erring path which they have followed so consistently is actually the reason for their ignorance of your planet's present instability. Through the ages, There have been many signs and omens which your people have ignored. Many of these have been recorded in your holy writ as prophecies. But your people heeded them not. And although many have already been fulfilled, the lesson has not been learned. It is not wise to become independent of the Creator of all. Mankind must be guided by the hand that has given him life. If man is to live without catastrophe, he must look upon his fellow being as himself, the one a reflection of the other. It is not the Creator's wish that mankind turn against itself in cruelty and wanton slaughter. I know, I said, that we are coming into a new major cycle of some sort. Some of my brothers on earth call it the Golden Age, others the Aquarian. Can you throw any light on this? On our planet we do not name the changes in that way, for all we know is progress. But to answer the question for your understanding, we would say that you are approaching a new cosmic age. However little you may understand this, you have had your Golden Age, worshipping gold more than God. And an Aquarian Age, as you call it, can be only one in which Earth afflicts you with great waters, or not enough. You have passed through both of these conditions. The very naming of the periods of change in this way is a part of the block to your understanding. The Earth people must learn to progress in rhythm with these natural changes and not be subject unto them. How, I asked, would you define the cosmic age? Actually, we would rather call it a cosmic understanding. This is the first time in your civilization that you have, in a broad sense, become aware of the probability of inhabited worlds other than your own, appearing in our spacecraft, as we now are doing in such numbers in all the skies of your world. Even those who would not believe have little choice. For the first time in the memory of mankind on your planet, there is overwhelming evidence that your planet has not borne life as a kind of freak accident, as even some of your greatest astronomers have stated. Mankind is manifesting on your world because that planet is but one in a vast, orderly creation of the Infinite One, all subject to His divine laws. Our ships perform feats in your skies which no earthly planes of any nation can do. Your scientists know this. Your governments know this. The pilots of your planes everywhere in your world have seen us and marveled. Thousands of your people have looked up and been amazed. Thousands more everywhere are now watching and hoping for a glimpse of us. All this has been foretold by men of old. They have said in your written prophecies that the whole world will be disturbed, and that the signs will be these: sons of God will be coming from heaven to earth to deliver the peoples. The conditions in your world today have placed you, as you put it, under the shadow of death. Your entire world is disturbed. And since the name you have for outer space is heaven, and since we too are sons and daughters of God, could it not be that even now the ancient prophecy is being fulfilled? It has also been foretold that, when the time cometh, the dark races of the world will rise up and demand the right to equal respect and the lot of free men so long denied them by you of lighter skins. Is not this prophecy, too, being fulfilled in these very days on earth? You see, we know the history of your world well. The conception of "we are our brother's keeper" applies to all mankind everywhere. It is in this role that we come to you and say, let the Supreme Being of the universe be the guiding word for your world, that your troubles may vanish as darkness before light. What would man be without the breath of life? And who giveth unto him? Is it not to be found everywhere for the benefit of all? Then let earthly man know that his God is not in some far distant place, but ever near in all manifestations, and within man himself. Orthon ceased speaking, and for a moment I sat with bowed head thinking of his words. Slowly, I became aware of a warmth that seemed to be entering into my spirit. Looking up, I saw from the faces of those around me that what I felt was a benediction that flowed from all of them toward me. Then the Master rose and approached me. As I stood, so did the others. "My son," he said, looking deeply into my eyes, "much of what our brother has been saying to you is in conflict with many things your people have been taught to believe as truth. This, in itself, is of no importance, since that which was learned yesterday serves only as a stepping stone toward the greater truth we can learn tomorrow. That is the law of progress. Once on the right path, it cannot be otherwise. It is essential always that men work and strive together with open minds, ever aware that all is never known. There is an infallible guide in determining whether the path is a right one. That is very simple. If the results of your thoughts and actions are evil, then the path you are following leads away from the light of His countenance. If good things follow along the way you go, then your lives, and the lives of your children and of their children, will be joyous. Blessings, unbroken by sickness and strife, will be your eternal heritage. He touched my hand in farewell and left the room in a silence vibrant with the words he had spoken. I looked long into the faces of my many friends, imprinting each on my memory. There were no spoken farewells, but each raised a hand, and I raised mine. Then, I allowed Orthon to lead me along the ways of the carrier back to the little scout. Both Firkin and Ramu accompanied me on the drive back to the city. We did not talk. When we were back at the hotel and the time had come for me to take leave of these dear friends, a feeling of tremendous poignancy engulfed me. We exchanged handclasps and Ramu said softly, "The blessing of the Infinite One go with you." I left them then, and went on up to my lonely room. Then some from another book of him. When we reached Desert Center, there to the right was the road for which we were looking, the highway leading to Parker, Arizona. The Baileys had brought a movie camera, which they had rented and with which they were not too familiar, and some extra film. The Williamsons had a still camera. Suddenly and simultaneously we all turned as one, looking again toward the closest mountain ridge where just a few minutes after a plane had crossed. Riding high, and without sound, there was a gigantic cigar-shaped silvery ship, without wings or appendages of any kind. Slowly, almost as if it was drifting, it came in our direction, then seemed to stop, hovering motionless. I said, "Someone take me down the road in the car, quick. That ship has come looking for me, and I don't want to keep them waiting. Maybe the saucer is already up there somewhere, afraid to come down here where too many people would see them." Faced with the fact that if there were a landing at this time, and if I were permitted a personal contact with the crew that landed, there was also a possibility that I, too, might be privileged to take a trip somewhere with them, even to the place wherever they came. Consequently, I wanted to be sure that those with me should witness my going. That was why I had cautioned all of my companions to watch very carefully to see whatever it might be possible for them to see at the distance they were from me. This distance was something between half a mile and a mile. Asked how long they should wait before returning for me, yet to be sure their presence would not interrupt anything that might be going on, I told Lucy to return for me in an hour, unless I signaled for them before that time. I explained that when the saucer left, if one did come in as I was hoping, I would walk to the highway and wave my hat. But in all cases, to return at the end of an hour because I was certain everything would be finished by that time. As the car was turned to obey my instructions, the big spaceship turned its nose in the opposite direction. Silently, but quickly, it crossed above the crest of the mountains and was lost to my sight. But not before a number of our planes roared overhead in an apparent effort to circle this gigantic stranger. Al and Lucy were able to keep it in sight longer than I because on the highway they were farther from the mountains. Not until they had joined the others did it disappear from their sight as it turned its nose upward and shot out into space, leaving our plane circling, with nothing. Alone with my telescope and my thoughts, I busied myself attaching the camera to the telescope and making adjustments with the eyepiece. This adjustment had become slightly distorted in the moving and setting up. All the time thoughts kept racing through my mind, possibilities of what could take place, fears that nothing would, wondering if the big ship would return, or if the planes had chased it away for good, if a strange craft did come close, would I get the kind of picture I wanted? One which would be convincing beyond all question to the general public, and a thousand other thoughts along this same line. And while I had long hoped for a personal contact with a man from a flying saucer, expectation that such would actually take place at this time was far from my mind. I was hoping for a good picture, a possible close-up of some spacecraft that would show more detail than I had ever before succeeded in getting. But from previous experiences, I would not have been too disappointed if nothing further had occurred. Not more than 5 minutes had elapsed after the car had left me when my attention was attracted by a flash in the sky, and almost instantly a beautiful small craft appeared to be drifting through a saddle between two of the mountain peaks and settling silently into one of the coves about half a mile from me. It did not lower itself entirely below the crest of the mountain. Only the lower portion settled below the crest, while the upper, or dome section, remained above the crest and in full sight of the rest of my party who were back there watching. Yet it was in such a position that I could see the entire ship as it hovered in the cove ahead of me. At the same time, many miles of the highway and surrounding terrain were in full view of the crew within the saucer. Quickly I spotted it in the finder on my telescope, and as rapidly as possible I snapped the 7 loaded films, without taking time to focus through the ground glass in the back of the camera. But I was hoping and praying all of the time that Lady Luck was with me and that the pictures would turn out well. As I removed each film holder with its exposed negative from the camera, an old Hague E. Dresden Griffles type, put it in the right-hand pocket of the jacket I was wearing. Here, I was sure, these films would be safe from any accident. I took the camera off and replaced it in the box in which I had brought it. I then decided to see what I could get with the brownie. As I snapped the first picture, I noticed the saucer flash brightly as it moved away and disappeared over the same saddle through which it had first come, just as a couple more of our planes roared overhead. I stood watching them as they circled a couple of times and then continued on their way. I was sure the saucer had again evaded them and was on its way to its mother ship. Then I decided to take a couple more pictures with the brownie just to show the general terrain in this section in case my spacecraft pictures turned out well. I still questioned whether or not they would. But this is always the case, and I never know until the finishing work is completed. I have never grown to the state of complete assurance of having a good picture, as expert photographers usually have when they take one. After taking 3 pictures with the brownie, I just stood there for a few minutes looking around and with the Kodak still in my hand. I was somewhat awed by being so close to a saucer, and I wondered if whatever or whoever was in it knew I was photographing it. I had a feeling that they did. I only wished I could have seen the one who was operating that beautiful craft and could have had a chance to talk to him. Maybe he would let me look inside. Suddenly my reverie was broken as my attention was called to a man standing at the entrance of a ravine between 2 low hills, about a quarter of a mile away. He was motioning to me to come to him, and I wondered who he was and where he had come from. I was sure he had not been there before. Nor had he walked past me from the road. He could not have come from the side of the mountains on which we were. And I wondered how he had crossed over and descended any part of them without me having noticed him. A prospector perhaps? Or someone living among these mountains? I had thought no one would be within miles of this spot when I chose it. Or could he be a rock hound, stranded way out here? But why was he motioning to me unless he needed help? So I started towards him, mentally questioning in a minor way, but still feeling the exaltation of my recent experience. As I approached him, a strange feeling came upon me and I became cautious. At the same time I looked round to reassure myself that we were both in full sight of my companions. Outwardly there was no reason for this feeling, for the man looked like any other man, and I could see he was somewhat smaller than I and considerably younger. There were only 2 outstanding differences that I noticed as I neared him. 1. His trousers were not like mine. They were in style, much like ski trousers, and with a passing thought I wondered why he wore such out here on the desert. 2. His hair was long, reaching to his shoulders, and was blowing in the wind as was mine. But this was not too strange, for I have seen a number of men who wore their hair almost that long. Although I did not understand the strange feeling that persisted, it was, however, a friendly feeling toward the smiling young man standing there waiting for me to reach him. And I continued walking towards him without the slightest fear. Suddenly, as though a veil was removed from my mind, the feeling of caution left me so completely that I was no longer aware of my friends or whether they were observing me as they had been told to do. By this time we were quite close. He took 4 steps toward me, bringing us within arm's length of each other. Now, for the first time I fully realized that I was in the presence of a man from space, a human being from another world. I had not seen his ship as I was walking towards him, nor did I look around for it now. I did not even think of his ship, and I was so stunned by this sudden realization that I was speechless. My mind seemed to temporarily stop functioning. The beauty of his form surpassed anything I had ever seen, and the pleasantness of his face freed me of all thought of my personal self. I felt like a little child in the presence of one with great wisdom and much love, and I became very humble within myself. For from him was radiating a feeling of infinite understanding and kindness, with supreme humility. To break this spell that had so overtaken me, and I am sure he recognized it for what it was, he extended his hand in a gesture toward shaking hands. I responded in our customary manner. But he rejected this with a smile and a slight shake of his head. Instead of grasping hands as we on Earth do, he placed the palm of his hand against the palm of my hand, just touching it but not too firmly. I took this to be the sign of friendship. The flesh of his hand to the touch of mine was like a baby's, very delicate in texture, but firm and warm. His hands were slender, with long tapering fingers like the beautiful hands of an artistic woman. In fact, in different clothing he could easily have passed for an unusually beautiful woman, yet he definitely was a man. He was about 5 feet, 6 inches in height and weighed, according to our standards, about 135 pounds. And I would estimate him to be about 28 years of age, although he could have been much older. He was round-faced with an extremely high forehead, large, but calm, grey-green eyes, slightly aslant at the outer corners, with slightly higher cheekbones than an Occidental, but not so high as an Indian or an Oriental, a finely chiseled nose, not conspicuously large, and an average-size mouth with beautiful white teeth that shone when he smiled or spoke. As nearly as I can describe his skin, the coloring would be an even, medium-colored suntan. And it did not look to me as though he had ever had to shave, for there was no more hair on his face than on a child's. His hair was sandy in color and hung in beautiful waves to his shoulders, glistening more beautifully than any woman's I have ever seen. And I remember passing thought of how Earth women would enjoy having such beautiful hair as this man had. As I said before, he wore no protection over it and it was being blown by the winds. His clothing was a one-piece garment which I had a feeling was a uniform worn by spacemen as they travel, like Earthmen in various types of work wear uniforms to indicate their occupations. Its color was chocolate brown and it was made with a rather full blouse, close-fitting high collar much like a turtleneck, only it did not turn down. The sleeves were long, slightly full and similar to a raglan sleeve, with close-fitting bands around the wrists. A band about 8 inches in width circled his waist. And the only break in coloring of the entire garment was a strip about 1.5 inches in width at the top and bottom of this waistband. This was brighter and more of a golden brown. The trousers were rather full and held in at the ankles with bands like those on the sleeves at the wrists, in style much like a ski pant. Actually, it is very difficult to describe this garment in coloring, for I know of no descriptive word in our language that would suit it perfectly. It was definitely a woven material, very fine, and the weave was different from any of our materials. There was a sheen about the whole garment, but I could not tell whether or not this was due to a finishing process or whether it might be the kind of substance of which its thread was made. It was not like our satin, silk, or rayon, for it had more of a radiance than a sheen. I saw no zippers, buttons, buckles, fasteners or pockets of any kind, nor did I notice seams as our garments show. It is still a mystery to me how his garment was made. He wore no ring, watch, or other ornament of any kind, and I saw nothing to indicate, nor did I have a feeling, that he had a weapon of any kind on his person. His shoes were red-brown in color. They too were made of some apparently woven material but different from his suit because these looked much like leather. It was soft and flexible because I could see the movement of his feet within them as we stood talking. High like a man's Oxford shoe, they fitted closely around his feet, which I would say were about size 9 or 9.5. However, the opening was on the outer side about halfway back on the heel between the arch and the back of the heel. Two narrow straps were here, but I saw no buckles or fasteners, and I reasoned that these straps must have the quality of stretching similar to the woven inserts in some women's shoes. The heels were slightly lower than on Earth men's shoes, and the toes were blunt. I noticed his shoes particularly because during our conversation he made it very plain to me that his shoe prints were most important. But more about that later. Suddenly realizing that time was passing and I was getting no information by just looking at him, I asked him where he came from. He did not seem to understand my words, so I asked him again. But his only response was a slight shake of the head and an almost apologetic expression on his face, which indicated to me that he was not understanding either my words or the meaning behind them. I am a firm believer that people who desire to convey messages to one another can do so, even though they neither speak nor understand the other's language. This can be done through feelings, signs, and above all, by means of telepathy. I had been teaching this as fact for 30 years and now I concluded I would have to use this method if information of any kind was to pass between us. And there were a lot of things I wanted to know, if I could only think of them. So, to convey the meaning of my first question to him, I began forming, to the best of my ability, a picture of a planet in my mind. At the same time I pointed to the sun, high in the sky. He understood this, and his expression so indicated. Then I circled the sun with my finger, indicating the orbit of the planet closest to the sun, and said, Mercury. I circled it again for the second orbit, and said, Venus. The third circle I spoke, Earth, and indicated the Earth upon which we were standing. I repeated this procedure a second time, all the while keeping as clear a picture of a planet in my mind as I was able to perceive, and this time pointing to myself as belonging to the Earth. Then I indicated him, with a question in my eyes and my mind. Now he understood perfectly, and smiling broadly he pointed to the sun, made one orbit, made the second, then touching himself with his left hand, he gestured several times with his right index finger toward the second orbit. I took this to mean that the second planet was his home, so I asked, "You mean you came from Venus?" This was the third time I had spoken the word Venus in relation to the second planet, and he nodded his head in the affirmative. Then he, too, spoke the word Venus. His voice was slightly higher pitched than an adult man's. Its tonal quality was more that of a young man before his voice completes the change from childhood to maturity. And although he had spoken but one word, there was music in his voice and I wanted to hear more of it. Next I asked, "Why are you coming to Earth?" This question too was accompanied with gestures and facial expressions as well as mental pictures, as were all the questions I asked of him. I repeated each question at least twice to be sure that he understood the meaning of the words I was speaking. The expressions of his face and his eyes told me clearly when he understood, or when there was still any uncertainty in his mind as to what I was trying to ask. I also repeated the answers he gave me to be sure that I was understanding him correctly. He made me understand that their coming was friendly. Also, as he gestured, that they were concerned with radiations going out from Earth. This I got clearly since there was a considerable amount of radiation of heat waves rising from the desert, as is often the case, such as the waves that are often seen rising from pavements and highways on hot days. He pointed to them and then gestured through space. I asked if this concern was due to the explosions of our bombs with their resultant vast radioactive clouds. He understood this readily and nodded his head in the affirmative. My next question was whether this was dangerous, and I pictured in my mind a scene of destruction. To this, too, he nodded his head in the affirmative, but on his face there was no trace of resentment or judgment. His expression was one of understanding, and great compassion, as one would have toward a much-loved child who had erred through ignorance and lack of understanding. This feeling appeared to remain with him during the rest of my questions on this subject. I wanted to know if this was affecting outer space. Again a nod of affirmation. In this respect let me say here, it has long been known by scientists of Earth that the cosmic ray, as it is called, is more powerful in outer space than it is in the Earth's atmosphere. And if this be true, is it not just as logical to assume that the radioactive force from the bombs being tested by nations of Earth could also become more powerful in space, once leaving the Earth's atmosphere? Logical deduction supports the statement of this spaceman, but I persisted and wanted to know if it was dangerous to us on Earth, as well as affecting things in space. He made me understand by gesturing with his hands to indicate cloud formations from explosions, that after too many such explosions. Yes,